She didn't know much about the place, but she could visualize it, a crescent-shaped archipelago in the middle latitudes between the Aleutians and Hawaii. It was the rim of a huge impact crater. Some of the islands were fairly large. The largest of them straddled the Antimeridian, 180 degrees east or west of Greenwich, which was the origin of the name. But most of the archipelago lay to the east of there, stretching all the way across the longitude of 166 degrees, 30 minutes west. That was the location of one of the two turnpikes that the Aeidians had built across the ring. It was as far west as the eye could travel, and so it served as a border between red and blue. Since it was in the middle of the Pacific, which, notwithstanding the best efforts of the hard rain, was still largely an empty expanse of water, there wasn't much of a land border. 166-30 did cross through Beringia, the union of Alaska with the easternmost part of Siberia. A land border did, therefore, exist in that place, as well as in the somewhat more climatically benign part of Antimer, lying a few thousand kilometers due south. This was the line of demarcation that Bard had alluded to, carefully omitting the mention of on which side of it the vineyard was actually located. The border was fuzzy. There was no need to bother with strict enforcement on a world so thinly populated. The much longer land border at 90 degrees east, above Dhaka, wandered all over the place as it rambled north across the broadest part of Asia, squirming this way and that to circumvent craters, Himalayas, and other complications. The general picture that Bard had therefore conveyed, in just a few words, was something like this. His clan, whatever that meant, of Neoanders, had gone down to the surface as soon as it had become livable. They might have been Sooners, which was what Cath too had been assuming of Tayuratam Lake, but, given their race, it was more probable that they had been military, sent down to Antimer, which was a fairly inviting piece of real estate, to secure it. For most of the Antimer chain lay on the red side of the line of demarcation, and constituted a valuable possession. But it had this troublesome extension onto the other side where Blue could, if it chose, establish a beachhead. From there, military incursions might be made westward in the event that the treaty failed. All of these things had come to pass during the war in the woods. During the treaty negotiations that had concluded it, Red had made efforts to claim all of Antimer for itself, effectively defining a little eastward excursion in the line of demarcation that would rid it of this particular thorn in its side. No agreement had been reached on that item, so it remained in dispute. Had more people been living there, there might have been a demilitarized zone, a no-man's land, and all the other apparatus of disputed Cold War boundaries. As it was, things were just fuzzy. A tacit agreement was in place not to stir up trouble. But on both sides it was heavily populated with military settlements and/or survey installations, just to keep an eye on things. The obvious explanation for a lot of Neoanders living there was that they'd been sent down as a military force and brought their families with them. Upon the expiration of their term of service, they had declined the invitation to return to whatever crowded space habitat had been their place of origin, and had dispersed into the countryside, which was said to be a very nice place to live. This was technically illegal, but Red authorities had probably looked the other way, figuring that ceding the place with Neoanders could only strengthen their hold on it. Their Neanderthal heritage had been fabricated out of whole cloth, yet it was taken more or less seriously by everyone. It was a sort of consensual, historical hallucination. Aida and some of her more bloody-minded descendants might have hoped it would instill fear of, or at least respect for, the fighting prowess of this subrace. Some Neoanders reveled in that. Many of them, however, preferred a revisionist view of Neanderthal history that painted them as highly intelligent. Their brains were larger than those of modern humans, artistically gifted, and essentially peaceful proto-Europeans. Neoanders of a more intellectual bent held seminars about it. More practical-minded ones tried to live it. There was no better place to live it, Cath too had to admit, than Antimer, which had a temperate, European-style climate. And so it was entirely plausible that a group of Neoanders who had been sent down by Red as shock troops would, within a generation or two, end up running vineyards in that fuzzily defined border zone, near the line of demarcation, and, once the vines had reached maturity, trying to sell wine on the ring. The early market would be high-end connoisseurs and restaurants, and so they would need a member of the clan who cleaned up well, had good manners, and knew how to wear clothes, to establish commercial contacts in places like Cradle. This entire picture, or something close to it, was summoned up in the minds of Cath Tu and presumably Ty and Bellid and the others as soon as the words were spoken. But Ty's remark, "That's one explanation for our not having met," and Bard's non-answer, "Did you have another possible explanation in mind?" were still lodged there awkwardly. Was Ty meaning to question Bard's story? The look on Ariane's face, as she regarded the Neoander, was not what you would call warm. But of course the Julian would be suspicious, would look for other explanations than what lay on the surface. Ty seemed to have noticed this too. His eyes were jumping back and forth between Ariane and Bard. Bard looked up at Ty and smiled, his huge upper lip pulling back to expose the row of yellowish enamel boulders planted in his upper jaw.
"I'll bet that as our seven spends time together, Tayur, Tom, and I will have all sorts of opportunities to tell colorful stories about what our families have gotten up to during their decades on the surface."
Which didn't answer the question. But it was charming, and it deflected the issue by making the point that Tayur, Tom Lake's background, should he choose to discuss it with them, was likely to be at least as complicated as that of Lengabard. Perhaps a bit of guilt-tripping there, too, implicitly asking them why they were so curious about the Neoander, when other members of the Seven might be worthy of some scrutiny, too. Ariane sat back in her chair and pretended to look at her fingernails. She was not the least bit satisfied. Trying for a minute to think like a Julian, Cath Tu imagined how it must look to her, a creature selectively bred by crazy people to be capable of killing with his bare hands, who at the same time was extraordinarily crafty in his social interactions.
"I am what I am," Ty said.
"And what is that?" Ariane asked.
"A bartender. Always happy to make new acquaintances."
He nodded at Bard.
"Or to provide guests with drinks. Anyone thirsty?"
No one admitted to being thirsty.
"For beverages, I meant," Ty added. "I'm sure we are all thirsty for knowledge."
Doc liked that.
"Knowledge in general, Tayur, Tom?"
"Oh, I'd be living on Stromness if I were a knowledge-in-general man," Ty said. "A collector of facts? No, I take a more utilitarian stance."
"Meaning that you would like to know why we are here?" Doc said.
Ty seemed to find the question overly blunt and raised the ridge of scar tissue that had once been a honey-colored eyebrow.
"If you'd enjoy saying something about it, I'd enjoy listening," he admitted. "If not, well, I'm willing to come along for the ride, up to a point."
Doc now looked across the table toward Ariane in a way that made tumblers click inside of Cath Tu's head. He was handing control of the meeting to Ariane. It might be going too far to say that she was in charge, but she was probably in communication with whoever was.
"Most of our operations will be on the surface," she said. "You might have inferred as much from the fact that we have gone out of our way to involve indigens," she glanced at Ty and Bard, "and survey personnel." She nodded at Cath Tu and at Bellid. The last gesture elicited another one of those sardonic snorts from Ty, pointing out apparently just how implausible it was that a man fitting the profile of Lieutenant Tomov could possibly be taken seriously as a member of Survey. Ariane gave Ty a cool look, as if to say, "Don't start," then continued, "And I need hardly belabor the long-standing connection with the surface embodied by Doc and Memmi." Conspicuously absent from the list now was Ariane herself, but if she was aware of the omission, she didn't show it. Everyone was left to make what guesses and assumptions they might about how her career, whatever it might be, was connected with the surface. Discretion is important, Arion continued, which is why we will tend to operate out of Cradle and use atmospheric or surface transportation, meaning airplanes and things that crawled on the surface of New Earth as opposed to rocket ships, bolos, and Aitken-Kucharski devices like giant whips. Whenever possible, we will enter and exit Cradle on foot, via the subterranean passages that are afforded by sockets. When's the next? Cathu started to ask.
Kayambe,
Arian said. 2 days from now. We are going to travel from Kayambe to Beringia on the surface? Cathu asked. Tai and Bard both looked at her curiously.
I haven't said anything about Beringia, Arion pointed out.
But it's obviously where we're going, Cathu said. It's where Belit and I, and a lot of other people, were sent on survey. It's where I saw what I saw and told Belit about it. This whole thing was precipitated by that, wasn't it?
It has been brewing for longer. Years, Arion said.
But you're not wrong. Ty's from that part of the world, I can tell by his accent. Bard is from south of there, on Antimer, Cathu went on.
We will head north from the Kayambe socket, yes, Arion said.
North a hill of a long way, Ty pointed out.
We are not prevented from using air transport, Arion reminded him.
If we can get a big enough glider, Cathu put in. The mountain wave will take us right up the Andes, the Sierras, and the Cascades in a day or two.
I am fairly confident, Arion said, that we can get a big enough glider.
The undersurface of Cradle, only visible to people standing on the ground, more specifically on the equator, looking up at it, was flat and generally egg-shaped, elongated in the direction of its east-west movement. On closer inspection, its mostly smooth surface was interrupted from place to place by small hatches, carefully engineered protrusions, orifices, and other details. These were distributed around that otherwise featureless surface in a way that suggested orderly minds at work, addressing complications posed by the asymmetries of the city above. In several places along the equator of New Earth, ground had been cleared and flattened, and reinforced concrete pads laid. These had the same size and shape as Cradle's undersurface, and were equipped with their own hatches and orifices matching those on Cradle. Cradle could be neatly set down into one of these sockets whenever the eye happened to be directly overhead. There it might reside for hours or days, taking on or discharging supplies, and otherwise communing with the surroundings. But it never stayed for long, since it had to follow the movements of the eye, which always had urgent business elsewhere on the ring. At such times, a traveler who knew nothing of orbiting tethers and the like, emerging from the woods or cresting some nearby hill and coming into view of Cradle, would perceive it as a normal, which is to say stationary, city. The bucket handle arching high over its top was a heavy hint that something was a bit odd about it. Other than that, however, it would look, in that context, like a somewhat isolated hill fort. Some of the more well-established sockets had begun to accumulate suburbs, ring-shaped towns that would come to life whenever Cradle was in residence. Most of them had the feel and shared the purposes of military bases, scientific installations, and frontier outposts. It had always been envisioned that many such would be built in time, creating a ring around the equator to match the habitat ring far above it, and that once New Earth was opened for general settlement, they would grow into important cities. To visit one now, centuries before its glorious peak, was something of an acquired taste, a little like walking around a building site after foundations have been laid and a few walls framed. Builders, dreamers, and people of imagination enjoyed such places. Others saw nothing. Kayambe and Kenya had been the first two sockets, built in the most likely sites on South America and Africa respectively. Each numbered about 10,000 souls. Kayambe's namesake was a volcano at the intersection of the Andes and the equator, in what had once been the country of Ecuador. It had, of course, taken a beating during the hard rain, and resumed erupting for a while,
but had now been dormant for about 700 years. In any case, the Cayambe socket had been built well clear of its most active vents, placing the volcano's summit, which was once again snow-covered, far enough away that it could be admired from any windows on Cradle that happened to be aimed in the right direction. The Crow's Nest's tower afforded views in almost all directions, and so Tayuratam Lake, standing behind his bar 2 days later, polishing a glass with a towel, and was able to look up between two tap handles and see the summit glide into view and then seemingly rise upward from the horizon as Cradle was lowered gingerly into its socket. Klaxons sounded all over Cradle and across the earthbound Ring City that was now coming into view beyond its windscreens. Out of habit, Ty stuffed the towel into the pocket of his trousers, letting it dangle down his leg, and reached out to steady himself against the bar. The underside of Cradle and the matching surface below it had been designed so that a disk of air would be trapped between them during the final meter of descent and act as a cushion. This was allowed to escape through a picket fence of vents aimed upward around the periphery of Cradle, and so final docking was, as usual, signaled by a roar of escaping air and plumes of condensed humidity jetting upward into the blue sky over the Andes. The mildest of lurches caused stored glasses and tableware to clink together in cabinets all over the bar. The klaxons in the vents went silent at the same time. Through the bar's windows, which Ty had left cracked open, he could hear the customary smattering of applause rising up from the stony streets of Capitol Hill. He checked his timepiece. A few politicians and generals, who had leaned back from their breakfasts to observe the docking and admire the profile of Cayambe Volcano, bent forward again, picked up their forks, and resumed their conversations. Cradle had just become the largest city on New Earth, and was scheduled to remain so for 24 hours. Its system of windscreens, built to shield the city from the blast created by its movement through the atmosphere, now seemed more like a barbican, thrown up in some past age to defend an old city, but now merely a historical curiosity and a dividing line between neighborhoods. Other than keeping a curious eye on all comings and goings through Cradle's 8 gates, quarantine made no effort to control the mingling of populations. Cradle's visits were so brief that to stop, examine, and question everyone passing between it and the sockets would have rendered the whole visit pointless. Thanks to this relaxed policy, the time it took for an average person to get from the nearest of the 8 gates to the Crow's Nest was 9 minutes. The first customer showed up in 7, breathing somewhat heavily, and requested a beer. Ty did not recognize him, but the next 2 faces that came in the door 30 seconds later were familiar. During the next quarter of an hour, the place filled up with a mixture of regulars, from Cradle and Cayambe alike, and curiosity seekers. Ty's staff, well accustomed to these surges, began to open up back rooms. Extra cooks came up through one of the back entrances and began to make use of mise en place that had been prepped the night before. Everything, in other words, ran smoothly, which was how Ty liked it. The ability of the Crow's Nest to accommodate a socket surge with no intervention from Ty, other than polishing a glass, was, in a sense, his life's work. He had done every job it was possible to do in this place, from floor mopper on upward, and learned over time to select and delegate the work to others who could do it better. He had advanced, in other words, to higher levels of mental activity, while always doing enough of the floor mopping and glass polishing to remain in physical contact with the business of the bar, and in human contact with the staff. His real job, the job that the owners paid him for, was to be an observer of the human condition, as it was so richly displayed from day to day within these walls. He was also a judicious manipulator of the human condition, in the sense of occasionally throwing people out, telling others to settle down in a manner so smooth and humorous that they didn't know they'd been told, and making others feel welcome when they seemed ill at ease. All of that was as fundamental to the operation of a bar as mopping the floor. Others on his staff could do such things almost as well as he. Ty had, in other words, developed the Crow's Nest into a sufficiently healthy and robust organism that it was possible for him to disappear for weeks, sometimes even months, without inflicting serious damage. In some ways, his occasional vacations
actually did more good than harm, in the sense that when he came back, he would commonly find that certain members of the staff had risen to the occasion and become more complete and effective human beings in his absence. He was quite certain that he could walk away from the bar forever now, and that it would not really miss him. But he was unlikely to do any such thing because it was literally his home. He lived in an apartment on the court behind it, and because the owners preferred that he stay. And the owners were among the very few members of all the human races about whose opinions Tayura Tom Lake actually gave a damn. They had pointed out to him that even a year's leave of absence, should he choose to take one, would benefit the crow's nest, in the sense that he would return to it with fresh eyes and immediately see how beneficial changes might be made. But he suspected that the true value of the business, in the eyes of the owners, was not the return it delivered on capital. That was probably close to zero. They might even be running a huge loss, for all he knew. Every month, Ty did the books and boiled all the numbers down to a single sheet of paper that he took to the bolt hole and slid across the table to the owner's representative. They never said much about it. Once a year, a question might be asked about one of the numbers, just as a way of letting him know that they were paying attention. But the owners really valued the crow's nest, partly as a cultural institution, and partly because it gave them access to the sort of information about the lives, thoughts, and deeds of important persons that could only be had in a bar. He did not care for elaborate goodbyes, particularly in a professional context where a fussy leave-taking might suggest that his going away was a big deal, implying that the staff might not be up to the job of keeping the business running. And so after a few minutes had passed, and he had exchanged looks, words, and jokes with a few leading citizens and well-known characters of Kayambe, just long enough to let it be known that he was here, he pulled the towel from his pocket, wiped his hands, and tossed it into the laundry chute beneath the bar. He lingered for a moment just to satisfy himself that the chute was not jammed, but it never was. Satisfied, he edged around the corner of the bar and walked to a table by the windows where Ariane, Cath-2, and Bellad were pushing empty plates away, having just concluded a hearty breakfast. Ty himself had eaten light an hour ago, as was his habit when he expected to spend a good part of the day airborne. "It'll be taken care of," he remarked, and got perfunctory thank yous from the Moiran and the Teclan. Ariane gave him what he could only guess was meant to be some kind of penetrating look, and nodded. The busy minds of Julian's exhausted Ty, and he tried to avoid getting drawn into their labyrinthine ways of thinking. Perhaps this Ariane had used whatever connection she had in the intelligence world to investigate him and the owners, and was drawing all sorts of conclusions, probably wrong ones, about what motivated him to give the 7 free drinks and meals. For it was obvious to Ty that Ariane worked in intelligence. He had seen many such people during the war, and he knew their ways. By now the others could navigate around the crow's nest, but there was an expectation that he would lead the way. This derived partly from the fact that it was, after all, his establishment. But even had they been dropped into some completely random location on the surface, they would have looked to him to take point, because that, for better or worse, was what Dynans did. Answering to a similar racial expectation, Bellad took up the rear. This was partly because his ingrained habits of courtesy and discipline obliged him to say, "you first," to all the others, and partly so he would wheel about and engage any foes who might assault the rear of the formation. Ty moved briskly to reduce the chance that he would be buttonholed by some prematurely drunk member of the Kayambe Chamber of Commerçants. Within a few moments, they had passed into a section of the bar that had not yet been opened to visitors, and thence proceeded down twisting stairways scarcely wide enough to accommodate Bellad's shoulders until they reached the triangular courtyard in the center of the compound. Its tropical flowers were glowing like gems in the hard white light of the Andes. 4 small cabs awaited them near the big gate that gave out onto the street. Cradle was almost devoid of 4-wheeled vehicles when it was aloft, but whenever it was socketed, the place was invaded within minutes by swarms of whatever rolling stock was skinny enough to negotiate its streets. Some of these moved goods, transshipping them from the eye to customers on the surface, or importing the produce of New Earth to Cradle.
Others carried passengers on errands to the Ring City and its hinterlands. One of the cabs was already occupied by Doc and Memmi, as could be inferred by the cases of Doc's support infrastructure strapped to its roof rack and the grab poised to scuttle after it. Bard had climbed into the second cab and was slouched down low. Neoanders were rare enough to draw notice and arouse curiosity in a manner that Ariane quite clearly did not want. He had been keeping to himself in his private room. Ariane climbed into the cab with him. It went without saying that it would be easiest for all concerned if Bellad took up a whole cab by himself, and so he did that. Ty and Kath, too, got into the last one. After Doc and Memmi's cab departed, a few minutes passed before Ariane gave her driver the go-ahead. Ty shifted impatiently in his seat, slightly jostling Kath, too. Cradle-compliant cabs did not have a lot of shoulder room. "What do you think she's doing?" Kath, too, asked. "Just making conversation. They both knew perfectly well what she was doing." "A caravan of four, leaving the crow's nest and not coming back? Too conspicuous for her taste," Ty said.
"At least there's no question of getting lost," Kath, too, remarked.
She ducked her head low so that she could peer out the window and get a look at the northern sky beyond the city. The sun shafted in and made her eyes glow, picking out glints of yellow in irises that were mostly green and brown. She didn't have the crazy yellow cat eyes of some Moirans, but there was a bit of that in her ancestral tree. She knew Ty was looking at her, but she didn't let on to being self-conscious, which he approved of. She was looking, of course, at the Aitken Loop that was their immediate destination, assuming that it was still operating, and she'd have reacted differently had it gone down. It was rising up out of a mostly suburban flink barn on the town's outskirts, surrounded by hangars and maintenance facilities for aircraft that ranged up and down the length of the Andes. "You have everything you need?" Ty asked. "It'll be a long day for you."
"It'll go by in no time," Kath, too, demurred, "because I'll be busy. It'll be long for you because you'll be bored. Did you bring a book?"
"People are my books," Ty said.
"But I did bring a couple, in case the people all go to sleep."
It was meant as a light joke, but he saw her face snag on it, wondering if he was trying to make a racial crack about Moirans. "An annoying habit that many people seem to have," he added. Apparently a mere two-cab caravan was not enough to trigger Ariane's anxieties, and so the one carrying Bellad and the one carrying Ty and Kath, too, departed in tandem and began to work their way through streets crowded with pedestrians. They could have done the first part of it more quickly on foot, but when they passed out through the vehicular gate and into the streets of Kayambe, things opened up quite a bit, and they were able to use streets that had been designed specifically for four-wheelers. The place seemed dustier than Ty remembered, or maybe he was just seeing it through visitors' eyes. Cradle Sophisticates would see its menagerie of robots as comically oversized and ramshackle, its people as a lot of jumped-up backwoodsmen. Ty's kind of people, in other words. The sort of person whose ancestors had stayed in the habitat ring and played by the rules, patiently awaiting the moment when Doc, or some successor of his, would cut the ribbon on New Earth and allow settlers to flood in, had complicated feelings about Sooners and Indigens. On the one hand, they were viewed as sharp operators, tricksters. At the same time, they were isolated bumpkins. Ty had learned early how to play both sides of the image. A stranger from the ring who took you for a wide-eyed rube would spill a lot of information before he came to understand the truth, and one who expected you to play tricks on him would let down his guard at the first show of honesty and plain dealings. If you took a large number of flinks, flying autonomous chain links, and joined them together into a long chain and connected its ends to make it into a continuous loop, and then got the whole loop moving through the air like a train composed of little airplanes, each using its stubby winglets to generate its share of the lift, then you had a thing known as an A-train, pronounced the way a resident of old New York would have said A-train. The concept was old enough that its etymology had been obscured by time. It might have been air train with the first R elided, or a contraction of Aitken train. Sometimes, as here, It was a captive A-train, passing continuously through a fixed installation on the ground and rising from there to a considerable altitude before reversing direction and plunging back down for another circuit. But A-trains could also fly freely in the air, a technology crazy enough that it had become associated with the Aiden big brains known as Jinns, or Gainies, and tended to be used only by Red. Presumably at Ariane's behest, they took a circuitous route to the A-train station, swinging wide around the hangar with the big queue on its roof. The caravan collected itself in an unmarked hangar on the edge of the military zone, which Ty viewed as a classic example of the not-quite-survey and not-quite-military style. There were no human personnel, just two copies of a specialized kind of grab posted at each of the wingtips of a big glider, nominal capacity 10. Adequate room for a 7, or so Ty thought, until he climbed aboard and found it preloaded with mysterious equipment cases. Cath, too, made a slow walk around the glider and then climbed aboard, pulled the door shut, and crawled forward onto the couch where she would spend the journey resting on her belly. Everyone else looked away, politely, as she got her urine collection system squared away. In front of her was the glass dome, more than a meter in diameter, that served as the aircraft's nose. Belled and Bard took opposite window seats in the back row of the passenger compartment. Doc sat in the front row, on the aisle, where he would have the best view forward over Cath-2's backside and out the dome. Memmi sat in the window seat next to him, and Ariane grabbed the seat across the aisle from him. Ty had his pick of a few seats in the midsection. He had noticed Ariane's preference for always sitting next to Doc. Were he a jealous sort, or the kind of person who liked having long conversations with eminent scientists, he'd have resented the way she monopolized him. Instead, he just found it kind of interesting, and wondered whether Doc would shoo her off at some point so that he could at long last talk to someone else. The glider began moving around, presumably because Cath-2 had told the grabs holding its wingtips to take it somewhere. The nose tilted down as they descended a ramp into the Flink barn. This was a noisy warren in which thousands of identical robots were hustling around in a manner that looked chaotic and organized at the same time, much like the impression you'd get staring into a beehive. For an earthbound loop system like this one, the Flinks had to be aerodynamic, so their inner skeletons were hidden beneath thin plastic fairings, making them into blunt-nosed cylinders, like large bullets, with a little waist in the midsection to give the universal joint freedom to bend this way and that. Each of these Flinks was about half a meter in diameter and 2 meters long, and weighed about twice what a large human weighed. Lying on the floor, they were helpless, and so grabs moved them around by getting them aimed in the right direction and then rolling them about like barrels, creating a scene that looked a little like a swarm of dung beetles going about their work. The general point of the operation seemed to be to channel the Flinks in the direction of troughs where they would naturally line up. This enabled them to couple themselves together into short segments of chain. The troughs had roller bearings that made it easy for chain segments to slide forward and back, like trains in a switching yard, and in this manner, chain segments could be added or subtracted from the A-train while it was operating. Which was to say, while the system was shooting it straight up into the air at high velocity and sucking it back in on the down leg. In one of those easy-for-machines, inconceivable-for-humans operations, a coupler on the glider's nose ended up being snapped to the tail end of a Flink chain that presently got concatenated onto the up leg. Rapidly brought up to speed while still in the confines of the Flink barn, the glider pitched upward sharply as it emerged into the light. It began to rise vertically, drawn behind the chain. Nothing was connected to the glider's tail. The loop had been deliberately severed, and so the system had ceased being an Aitken loop. It was now a vertical bullwhip, accelerating the glider to higher and higher velocity as the Knickstella at its apex propagated skyward. Lying now on his back, staring straight up over Cath-2's shoulders, Ty could see small aerodynamic vanes that had deployed from the fuselage of the Flink ahead of them. These, like all the other vanes on all the other thousands of Flinks in the chain, effected tiny adjustments to keep the whip trimmed in just the right configuration. The result, a few moments later, was that the glider came snapping over the top just as its connection to the last flink was severed. In a few seconds, it had been hauled 2,000 meters straight up and let go with a velocity of a few hundred kilometers per hour. Meanwhile, every other flink in the chain had decoupled itself fore and aft, causing the entire chain to disintegrate into a linear cloud of identical fragments, each headed in a different direction. Each flink, sensing that it was aloft and alone, automatically deployed large tail vanes that turned it from a bullet into a badminton shuttlecock. The flinks rapidly slowed down to their terminal velocity, turned nose down, and began to fall toward the ground. A slight canting of the vanes caused them to begin spinning like maple seeds, further slowing their descent, and in this manner, the entire swarm began to descend in the direction of an empty lot adjacent to the flink barn. All of which had to be pictured in Ty's mind's eye, since they already had left it far behind. But he had seen it many times, as it was one of the basic operations carried out many times a day at any A-train port. The same flinks, organized in a different way, might just as easily have affected a high-altitude rendezvous with an orbiting bolo, or collected an aircraft and drawn it back downward to safe haven in the barn. The first half-hour of the flight was a little unsettling to Ty's stomach, as Kath too made a few sudden maneuvers, perhaps because she had sensed good air in one direction or bad in another. People who were accustomed to flight and powered aircraft frequently had trouble adjusting to the unpredictability of gliders, but Ty, who had done it before, understood that Kath too was just hunting for the right way to inject them into the mountain wave, hovering invisibly in the upper atmosphere above the Andes crest. He knew she had found it when the juking and jiving stopped, and the back of the seat pressed him forward with palpable acceleration. They were in level, steady flight now, proceeding north at something like 300 kilometers per hour. Kath Tu's task, henceforth, would be to look far into their future with her LIDAR-enhanced sensorium and make small adjustments needed to dodge pockets of rough air. Everyone became somewhat listless and fell to reading books or napping. Sitting a couple of rows behind Ty, occupying most of a pair of seats, was Beled Tomov. He was in an attitude of repose, whitish blue eyes half closed and unfocused, but aimed generally out the window. He was probably trying to maintain a visual fix on the horizon as a way to stave off motion sickness. In any case, he did not look to be in a social mood. Over a series of meals and drinks since the initial meeting of the Seven, Ty had been able to piece together a vague picture of the mission that Kath Tu and Beled had recently completed in Beringia. Apparently, Beled had been trying to maintain some kind of threadbare cover story about being a survey. Fortunately, this had now been dispensed with, and Doc was openly addressing him as Lieutenant Tomov. Military were divided into three broad groups, generally known as button pushers, ground pounders, and snake eaters. Beled, clearly, was no button pusher. That was the only branch of the service where Ivans, and even Kamites, were present in any numbers. That narrowed it down to ground pounder or snake eater. He seemed too elite to be a ground pounder, the sort of regular troops who would be deployed in large formations along borders on the surface. Oh, it wasn't out of the question. He might simply have been an unusually big and strong GP. But more likely he was a snake eater, which was to say a former GP who had been promoted into one of a few special purpose branches. Those had informal names too. Queeds, quarantine enforcement and detention, Feelies, forward intelligence, and Zerks, a contraction of berserkers. Queeds had by far the lowest status. They were looked at somewhat askance because of their status as what amounted to riot police, called in to quell domestic disturbances, but more often just posted near gates to remind people not to make trouble. Popular estimates of their intelligence and moral fiber were none too generous. Ty could not see why such a person would have been chosen for the Seven, and so he deemed it unlikely. Forward intelligence was a better fit, and an obvious guess, since Ty already knew that Beled had very recently been called back from the surface, where he had been moving about on what sounded like a classic feely kind of mission. Reference had been made to the fact that Bellet had passed near at least one Riz and observed its inhabitants without himself being seen, which was just the sort of thing Feelies were supposed to be good at. The only thing that prevented Ty from simply pigeonholing Bellet as a classic Feely was his physique. Because of that, he must allow for the outside chance that Bellet Tomov was a Zerk. But only an outside chance, because, contrary to their image in popular entertainment, Zerks were not all huge and muscular. Most of them looked reasonably normal, if unusually fit. The Zerks were not a single unitary force, but a mosaic of small units, each of which was trained and equipped for a special type of activity, such as fighting in space units in zero-G, fighting underwater, being dropped from the sky in pods, or cloak-and-dagger urban shenanigans. Thus far, Bellet Tomov had not shown any clear signs of such specialization. The steps he was taking to avoid motion sickness suggested that he was not accustomed to airborne work. If Ty had to guess, he'd say that this man had started out as a ground pounder, spent a lot of time on the surface in a border zone, distinguished himself, been promoted from the ranks, and ended up in some kind of tiny Zerk unit that specialized in sneaking around on the surface. The only one showing signs of life was Langobard. This stood to reason, since he had been confined to quarters for a few days. Ty moved back, sat next to him, and asked him about his clan's vineyard in Antimer. It was a wholly reasonable line of inquiry from a cradle bartender, but both men probably understood that it was just an icebreaker. Bard was more than happy to play along, and talked for a while about the volcanic soil of his homeland, how the terraform had converted it, in the last few centuries, from a dead mineral rubble to an ecosystem, and how his grandparents had smuggled grapevines down from various botanical gardens in both blue and red, and suffered through various misadventures on their way to figuring out that certain soil amendments were needed to make it work. Implicit in that story was that they must have been working with some people who weren't Neoanders. Smuggling unauthorized plant species down to the surface would have been dicey enough for members of that race, if done entirely within red. On the blue side of things, Neoanders would have been absurdly conspicuous, liable to being detained and searched by the Q, even when they weren't engaged in illegal activity. When Ty pointed that out, Bard said yes while shaking his head no, as if to say, "But of course, what you are saying is obvious." He went on to explain that his people, stationed for over a decade along a border that was entirely peaceful, had over time established cordial relationships with their opposite numbers on the blue side of the line, which had begun with swapping supplies to enliven their respective diets and progressed to picnics, athletic competitions, and other ways of relieving the boredom. The Teclans, he reported with a glance toward the slumbering Bellet, had been standoffish, but his people had always had good relations with Dynans. Ty saw no reason to doubt the historical truth of this remark, but he understood that Bard meant it on another level as well, as an overture to Ty, which might lead to friendship. Certainly there were grounds, other than that, for the Dynan and the Neoander to understand each other. Both were indigens who had found lives in the more sophisticated environment of Cradle, but still maintained connections to the surface, connections that were second nature to them, but in the context of the habitat ring at large, were fantastically unusual.
"Well, that's good," Ty said. "I was raised to be scared to death of your lot." "Of course you were. How far from the border did you grow up?"
By this, Bard meant the place where 16630 cut across Beringia, a boundary zone similar to that farther south in Antimer. The west or red side of it corresponded roughly to what had once been Siberia, and the east or blue side to Alaska. The irony being that the two continents had been rejoined by the hard rain, but then sundered by an imaginary line.
"Oh, we moved about," Ty said. "Remember, unlike your folk, we lacked a legitimate excuse for being there."
The Neoander's huge, highly expressive features reflected a bit of disappointment that his question hadn't really been answered.
"Too close to the line, and we were at risk of being arrested by the Blues stationed there, or being cooked and eaten by Neoander raiding parties," Ty cracked.
It was one of those jokes that was in such exceedingly poor taste that it could go either way, make Bard an enemy for life, or convince him that Ty really did understand. As a conversational gambit, it was somewhat risky. But on the other hand, Ty was cooped up on a glider with six strangers en route to a mission that hadn't been explained yet. The cargo hold had been preloaded with unmarked cases, some of which obviously contained weapons. At least three of the seven, Bellad, Langobard, and Tyuratam, knew how to use them, and Cath 2's survey training had included a short course on how to use a cat in a pinch. It was not the time or the place for the sorts of elaborate conversational niceties and courtship dances that might be expected in, say, an old private club on Cradle. More important was to get things sorted in a hurry. Bard laughed and shook his head.
"Why not move farther east, then?" he asked. "Get away from those threats altogether." "Because the early Sooner toeholds weren't really sustainable, and we had to trade with Blues for vitamins." "Under the table, I presume?" "Of course." "What did you give them in return? Your women?"
It was fair payback for the cooked and eaten joke. Bard testing him in return. Ty took it in stride.
"They were scared of our women. Happy Dinah's Day, by the way."
"Is it Dinah's Day? I've lost track."
But it didn't matter. Having made a crack about Dinan women, Bard had to pay respect to their eve.
"No," Ty continued. "To answer your question, it's the same thing that led your ancestors to trade victuals across the line."
"A craving for greater variety in the diet," Bard said. "More powerful in the end than sex."
"Yes. Early on, we had nothing more to offer them than fresh vegetables."
"Up there?" "Summer days are long. You can grow a lot in a crude plastic greenhouse. Later, as the ecosystem spun up, it was meat from small animals, berries, and a few luxury goods like furs."
A thought occurred to Bard.
"And how far would your people range in search for those things?"
He was referring, as Ty understood, to Cath 2's story about the camouflaged indigen in the trees. For she had by now shared this with the others.
"Not that far," Ty said.
In the vast and ancient undertaking called the Terraform, survey was a small department, sometimes viewed as a receptacle for eccentric or troublesome personnel. Its outposts were small and, because they needed to be sighted along rapidly changing frontiers, makeshift and temporary. Terraform bases, by contrast, tended to be much larger and more permanent. As a rule, they were sighted on islands off the coasts of continents. There was a logical scientific reason for doing it thus, but as Doc himself freely admitted, the real reason was more aesthetic and symbolic. Most of the sophisticated genetic sequencing laboratories and the staff needed to make them work were up in the ring, where space was tight, but brains were plentiful. Terraform installations on the surface were of a more practical character, and they sprawled over territory in a way that looked extravagant and unruly to habitat dwellers. They combined the functions of botanical garden, experimental farm, arboretum, zoo, and microbiology lab. Small samples, cuttings, or populations of bugs, plants, or beasts that had been developed and nurtured on the ring were dropped in such places to be propagated and observed before being shipped in quantity to the biomes where they would be allowed to run wild. Placing the bases on islands was a simple method for limiting the spread of plants and animals that had escaped from their assigned habitats. It was very far from being foolproof, but it was simple, easy, and fairly effective. An easy fit, in other words, for the get-it-done school. The Terraform base for the Central American Isthmus was Magdalena. This was a large island in about the same place as the former Islas Marias. Pre-Zero, this had been an archipelago off the west coast of Mexico, somewhat south of the tip of Baja California. The hard rain had reforged it into a single island with a few rocks and reefs scattered about, useful for propagating life that was designed to occupy shallow water and tidal zones. The lack of a moon
meant that New Earth's tides were caused entirely by the gravity of the sun, which made them weaker and more closely synchronized with the cycle of night and day. Because tidal zones were thought to have disproportionate importance to the ecosystems of land and sea alike, much terraform brain power had been focused on them, and the low-lying banks of wave-washed rubble around Magdalena had become spawning grounds, not just for fish and birds and crustaceans, but for researchers with advanced degrees. Doc himself had spent 10 years of his life here, sloshing through tide pools with buckets and shovels. Ty would not have thought it possible, but Cath 2 got them there with a little bit of daylight to spare in a single day's flying. Around midday, she mumbled something about a noteworthy jet stream perturbation and the possibility, which to her was apparently quite enticing, of catching a stratospheric wave. To Ty, it might as well have been eye of newt and toe of frog, wool of bat and tongue of dog. Her next words, though, had been admirably clear. "Hang on!" Drinks were spilled and barf bags reached for all around the cabin. Oxygen masks dropped from the ceiling as the glider shot up through the tropopause, and the fuselage creaked and keened as Cath 2 trimmed it to peel energy from some kind of fascinating upper atmosphere anomaly. Several hours later, when, after another understated warning, she banked it nearly upside down and let it dive toward the faintly wrinkled blue water of the Pacific, they had covered many hundreds of kilometers beyond their original flight plan, and their only real problem was dumping energy so that they could make a landing, as opposed to a crater, on Magdalena. The place had a flink barn, but the loop wasn't operating at the moment, and anyway, there was no reason to attempt a mid-air rendezvous with a flying chain when a simple airstrip was available nearby. An impressive whine sounded through the airframe as Cath 2 turned on a pair of turbines in its belly that took in air through scoops and converted its energy to electrical power that was then stored. The next time the glider took off, the whole system could be run backward, driving the turbines as jets to provide some initial energy boost. It wasn't necessary, but it was a way to slow the glider down, and it was a courtesy for the next pilot. Owing to some low banks of clouds, not much about the last phase of the flight made sense to its passengers, but at length the glider shot out the bottom of that weather system, and suddenly Magdalena was below them, lit up on its west side by the last of the setting sun. On the purple skin of the sea, thin arcs of foam materialized as incoming wave fronts sensed the bottom or wrapped around submerged reefs. Doc had moved to a window seat so that he could peer down at his old stomping grounds, and in the suddenly quiet cabin, Ty was able to hear him remarking on various installations along the shore. Most of these just looked to Ty like picket lines of pilings and ragged shanties of fishnet and plastic. But as Ty had been explaining to Langobard earlier, his sooner ancestors had made a living from meaner tech than that, and so he did not think less of the scientists who had built them. The wildlife habitats, arboretums, and gardens tiling Magdalena's western slopes looked a little closer to what a member of the general public might expect from a major terraform base, and the buildings clustered at the end of the airstrip were as respectable a town as it was possible to find anywhere on the surface. Ramps, stairs, and a long zigzagging road connected it to a harbor a couple of 100 meters below, where, at a glance, perhaps 8 significant vessels, a giant flying boat called an Ark, and many smaller boats were moored. They enjoyed a brief panorama of the waterfront before the final bank around and approach took them out of view behind some hills. After the excitements of the flight, the landing was dull, and Ty suspected that Cath 2 had just turned it over to an algorithm. The glider touched down on the single wheel that peeked out from the underside of its fuselage. Before it had slowed to the point where it might teeter sideways, a couple of specialized high-speed grabs had caught up with it, moving in the somewhat disturbing, prancing, scuttling gait that they used at such times, and caught hold of the wingtips. They escorted it to a field of tie-downs off to the side of the airstrip. Cath 2, relieved of responsibility, rolled over onto her back, stretched, and rubbed her eyes. Ty was eager to disembark, but he knew that Doc would be the first out the door. He knew this because he could see a considerable welcoming party walk jogging toward them. Ariane was looking at the same thing. Tai did not understand why she would be so secretive on Cradle and in Kayambe, only to land them in the one location on the surface where Doc was most famous. He guessed she had her reasons, worked out in painstaking detail, and never to be shared with the likes of Tai. They had to land somewhere en route to whatever their final destination was, and perhaps Terraform was enough of a closed community that the buzz Doc would create by landing here would not extend much beyond Magdalena. About 20 years ago, around the time of his 100th birthday, Dr. Hu Noah, like all Ivans, he put his family name first, because it was somehow supposed to be more logical, had made a conscious decision to give up on trying to explain to younger people just how little he had actually changed with age. It didn't really matter that these people were making all sorts of wrong assumptions about how his mind and his body were changing. What mattered to them, he had finally come to realize, was that they believed such things to be true. It was more important to them to believe it than it was for him to explain the facts of the situation. And so he had decided to let them think what they thought and to try to find constructive ways to use it. Sometimes this meant sitting so quietly that they forgot he was there and began speaking of him in the third person, using remembrance as a sort of interpreter. Sometimes he could astonish by speaking up, making it clear that he had been following the conversation all along. Or he would stand up, an action that was always described later by witnesses as springing to his feet, even though it was nothing of the sort, and begin to move about under his own power, which many who didn't know him well seemed to consider miraculous. Because remembrance was always by his side, and his grab was always scuttling along beside him, giving him a sort of universal banister and grab rail, people assumed he was more unsteady than was really the case. In fact, this support system was nothing more than a simple way of playing the odds. A fall could cripple or kill him. Why not have the grab handy? And remembrance, though she was assumed by most to be a healthcare worker, was really more of a general-purpose aide-de-camp, and, to put it crudely, a cow-catcher for turning human obstacles out of his path. He had had many conversations during his long life. Some were fascinating, and stayed with him more than a century later. Others were less so. As a younger man, he had tolerated those as part of the cost of doing business, a sort of tax that all people must pay in order to take part in civilized society. When he had turned 100, he had decided to stop paying that tax. Henceforth, he would engage only in conversations that really interested him, which, with a few exceptions for close friends and family members, meant conversations with a purpose. Remembrance carried in her head a list of all the people whom Doc might actually care to have a conversation with, and knew how to turn the others aside, typically by playing the age card. The list changed slowly over time, and certain people, some of whom were quite important, were occasionally discomfited to find that they were no longer on it. The list had been written down only once 20 years ago, when Doc and Remembrance had established their relationship. She had committed it to memory and destroyed it. It now existed only in her, not Doc's, head. Perhaps 10% of the original names remained. Many of them had died. The others had been crossed off, almost always without any volition from Doc. Remembrance stayed off to one side during his conversations, on the pretext that she might be needed to intervene medically. But what she was really doing was following the dialogue and monitoring Doc for signs. Not that his heart was failing or his medication wearing off, but that he was bored. Sometimes, during their first decade together, he had gone so far as to glance in her direction and catch her eye for a moment while his interlocutor wasn't looking, and this had been enough to eliminate that person from the list. But since then, it had no longer been necessary. In many cases, Remembrance had made what Doc had, at the time, considered to be mistakes in her performance of this duty, but on further consideration, he had seen what she had seen quicker, and come to agree with her. Exceptions had to be made for cases like this one, where they had to work with the 5 other members of the 7. Some, but not all of these, might have made their way onto Remembrance's list. He had tried to select people such as Kath Too, whom he enjoyed talking to, but the others were strangers to him. Ariane Casablancova showed an amusing pretension in sitting next to him whenever she could, acting as a gatekeeper between Doc and the remaining four. She took at face value Remembrance's cover story. Had Remembrance not been a Chemite, she might have taken it wrong, seeing it as an usurpation of her prerogatives. But that plus the fact that she had lifetime tenure, a sort of platonic marriage to Doc, made Ariane's behavior at most a source of dry amusement. The system worked beautifully at times such as this one, when a delegation of senior terraformers had gathered outside the door of Doc's glider to belabor him with a welcome. It wasn't that they were insincere, just that their quite genuine desire to greet him was all mixed up with other hopes and needs. One might want to get a photograph with him, but be bashful and tediously indirect about making the request. Another might feel that her life work had been unfairly slighted by her peers, and would desire some sign of affirmation from Doc. Yet another might be embroiled in some internal political drama of terraform, and would hope to gain some currency by being seen on Doc's arm. None of it was wrong or unreasonable, but all of it was a waste of time where he was concerned. Just further examples of that tax he didn't want to pay anymore. Knowing this without being told, Remembrance exited the glider first. Doc watched out the window as the delegation huddled around her, leaning in close to hear her quiet voice, and furrowed their brows and made exaggerated nods as she explained to them just how exhausted Doc was. At some point, she gestured back toward the glider, and all of them looked up in unison and saw Doc's face framed in the window. He made the faintest of waves, and they all showed their teeth and saluted him in the various styles of their races, mostly Ivan and Moiran. Once that was seen to, Doc sprang to his feet with a tug on the handle of his grab, made his way to the door, stood framed there for a few moments so that they could take their pictures, and then made a great show of descending the stair that had folded down from the vehicle's fuselage. The delegation tracked him across the apron of the airstrip, surrounding him in a great loose cloud, but not subjecting him to the tiresome demands of polite social interaction. Ariane was right behind, and the remaining four trailed at a distance, completely ignored. Ariane had gotten that right, at least. To the kinds of people who lived here, Doc's arrival on Magdalena was such a sensation that even a Neoander went unnoticed. After Remembrance had turned aside all invitations and offers of hospitality, he dined in his room with Ariane, who reveled in the attention. Tomorrow things would be different, and she would have to begin adjusting. And the darkest part of that adjustment, which for a Julian could get very dark indeed, she would look back on this meal and understand it for what it really was, a gesture of respect from Doc that could not be gainsaid by any of the voices muttering away between her ears. Doc asked her about her upbringing on Astrakhan, which was a smallish, almost pure Julian habitat at 48 degrees 6 minutes east, near the center of the Dynan part of the ring. This anomaly had come about as the result of a vision, in both the literal and figurative senses of that word, of a Julian man named Tomac, who had raised funds and established it as a quasi-religious outpost very early in the history of the ring. In those days, being 3 degrees and 6 minutes away from a capital such as Baghdad made it seem like a remote frontier outpost. Since then, of course, the Dynan segment had filled in around it, crowding it between much larger and more modern habitats. But Astrakhan, with a few modern improvements, continued to support some tens of thousands of souls, and was often alluded to by Julians as evidence that their race, though lacking in numbers, was as well established in blue as any of the four. It was frequently visited by scholars in the field of amistics, the study of the choices made by different cultures as to which technologies they would embrace or spurn. This was because Tomac, who'd had peculiar ideas about everything, had made some unusual and instructive choices as far as that went. The isolation of Astrakhan made it a useful test case. For her part, Ariane laughed off many of the quasi-religious aspects of the culture in which she had been raised, but Doc sensed that she had been doing so because it was expected of her. Later, as Remembrance was helping him into bed and getting him tuned up for the night, he told her that tomorrow he would begin getting to know the other four members of the Seven a little better, and that he would politely decline Ariane's assistance in doing so.
Ariane would have gloried in the opportunity to furnish Doc with dossiers full of statistics and hours of personal gossip about Belled, Cathtu, Tayuratam, and Langobard. But Hu Noah had always felt uncomfortable with such disclosures because they raised the obvious question of what was being disclosed by the same person to other curious minds about Doc. At 5 o'clock the next morning, Doc was in the recreation center, walking very slowly on a treadmill, when Belled Tomov came in for his daily workout. Belled's double take was so amusing that even Doc, who had made an art form of appearing not to know what was going on, was hard-pressed not to laugh at the poor fellow's expense. Even Remembrance, sitting nearby and reading, felt it best to interpose her book between her face and Belled's startled gaze for a few moments.
"Lieutenant Tomov," Doc said. "I thought you'd never drag yourself out of bed."
Belled remembered his manners and saluted.
"I hope you won't think me rude if I don't reciprocate," Doc said,
and nodded down at the treadmill's handlebars.
"I have a death grip on these."
Belled was looking around for Ariane. Doc decided not to make any comment.
"Is it your practice to warm up first?"
he asked.
"It is not considered necessary," Belled answered.
"Ah, too bad. I was thinking we might go for a stroll together," Doc said,
nodding at the empty treadmill next to him.
"That can be done," Belled allowed, "if I may stroll at a different pace."
"Suit yourself," Doc said. "There is a reason I did not attempt this in the wild."
Within a few minutes, the Teclan, now stripped to nothing but a pair of briefs, was running flat out on the treadmill next to Doc's, his hands blades, his arms scissoring, the soles of his bare feet skimming across the textured belt of the treadmill rather than pounding it. Engineered and bred to be a match for Neoanders, Teclans were at a genetic disadvantage because they were built like modern humans and did not partake of Neanderthal DNA. Bard could sleep in, eat and drink whatever he wanted, and still be as strong as the much larger Teclan. This was all perfectly academic, since no one seriously expected Belled and Bard to get into a fight, but it was a cultural habit of long-standing that Teclans measured themselves against Neoanders, and used the comparison to spur themselves to even greater diligence than would have been their habit anyway. In a calm and level tone of voice, as though he were sitting on a couch sipping tea, Belled said,
"I never thanked you for sending me on the mission just completed. I assume it was your doing, but I had no way to reach you. I thank you now."
Doc's eyes strayed to a regularly spaced line of scars wrapping around the small of Belled's back, some forming deep craters in the twin pilasters of muscle bracketing his spine. Bisecting that formation was a long vertical scar running right over the lumbar vertebrae, where surgeons had gone in and done something. Doc didn't know the details, to repair damage to the spinal column, and, he supposed, add some hardware or bone grafts.
"It was the least I could do," Doc said. "And given what happened in Tibet, I thought you might be better qualified than most to address certain plausible complications that might arise."
"So we will be operating near the border," Belled replied.
His tone said that he had long ago surmised this, and only wanted final confirmation.
"We will go where the investigation takes us," Doc said.
This surprised Belled slightly, producing a hiccup in his gait, which he spent a few moments resolving.
"These wanderers,"
Doc went on,
"do not seem to be great respecters of borders, or have anything to do with treaty, and so I thought it best to construct the 7 of persons of like mind."
"Is it to be Beringia, then, or Antimer?"
"Probably both. Antimer, of course, is closer, a short hop from Hawaii, which is today's destination. But as the trail is warmer in Beringia, I think we shall go there first."
Hawaii they reached before nightfall, traveling as passengers on a colossal terraform vehicle, not really an airplane and not really a boat, that skimmed over the surface at an altitude of no more than 4 meters. Ground effect vehicles of this class were called ARCs.
They had been designed to deliver massive quantities of plant and animal biomass, nurtured at big offshore terraform bases such as Magdalena, to literal destinations, where they could be slammed down into their new homes or else transferred to other vehicles for shipment inland. Only 10 of them had ever been built, and only 6 remained in service. This one was called Ark Mediba, after a Moiran biologist of the 4th millennium, who had in turn been named in memory of a hero of old Earth. If their theme was to travel unobtrusively, then Ark Mediba was certainly the vehicle for it, being a cavernous, reeking warren of animal pens, fish tanks, bug boxes, and racked peat pots in which exotic plants were growing in stews of manure. A ship making the same run, 5,000 kilometers due west, would have taken several days. Provisions would have been needed to feed the beasts, clean the cages, and water the plants. This howling, hammering monstrosity did it in 12 hours, a span brief enough that just about any living thing could survive it without victuals beyond water and perhaps a bit of a snack. In it, the 7 basically disappeared. As the Ark's dozens of turbofans roared into life and it began to chunder across Magdalena's harbor, the noise level rose to the point where they could do nothing but insert the earplugs they'd been issued and distribute themselves around the cargo hold in places where the stink wasn't too bad. Doc and Memmi were given special dispensation to enjoy the journey in a tiny capsule near the cockpit, where members of the flight crew could sleep and recreate during multi-day flights. The rest of them just tried to make themselves as comfortable as they could and waited for it to be over. Terraform had come late to Hawaii. The place was small, idiosyncratic, far away, and complicated, best left for last, after major continents had been booted up. The hard rain had loosened the lid on the geological hotspot that had built the islands, reawakening dormant volcanoes on existing islands, while causing a seamount southeast of the big island to develop, ahead of schedule, into a bigger island. This had merged 1,000 years ago with the former to make a bigger island yet, most of which was still too hot and toxic for Terraform to bother with. But there was a cove on its north coast, called Mokupuku after a tiny island that had once stood approximately in the same place, around which things were cool and quiet enough to be worth seeding. There, around sunset, Ark Mediba effected a sort of controlled crash landing, skidding to a halt offshore of a small terraform installation of the sort that were now scattered all over New Earth. Such as these were the epicenters of the ecological earthquakes that the human races had, for about 3 centuries, been unleashing on the surface. Sometimes they got their deliveries straight from the sky, other times, as in this case, from arcs dispatched out of the larger surface installations. Older ones were clusters of hemispherical domes, because they had been constructed before New Earth even had a breathable atmosphere. Newer ones, like this, had a somewhat more welcoming appearance. But their basic purpose was to work with beasts, bugs, and plants, and so their fragrance and the overall style of their operations lay somewhere on a continuum between farm and zoo, with the odd dash of science lab. None of it would have seemed remarkable, at least on an olfactory level, to the vast majority of human beings who had lived on old Earth in the millennia leading up to the scientific revolution, but the people who endured that voyage in the cargo hold of the great plane boat were fortunate that the fuselage wasn't pressurized and that ocean air could therefore filter through it. The staff were almost all Moirans, with a sprinkling of Kamites, and one visiting scientist who looked like a Dynan Ivan breed. Obvious to Kath, too, and probably to the others as well, was that her kin had slept long and hard after coming to this place, where they were cut off from the rest of their race while continually exposed to the pheromones, smells, calls, and behaviors of those animals and plants. Resulting epigenetic shifts had rendered them well qualified to do this kind of work, to do it all day long, and to live here indefinitely. This truly was the back of beyond, even more isolated than certain boneyard habitats that had become proverbial for remoteness, and the Moirans here all shared a kind of thousand-yard stare that was only intensified by the fact that they were predominantly green-eyed. They moved slowly, they appeared to think slowly, and they were always reacting to stimuli, auditory, olfactory, imaginary, that Kath, too, could not even detect.
The existence of 7 distinct human races, as well as various Aiden sub-races, provided modern society with a rich fund of opportunities for socially awkward happenings. The few hours they spent on the beach at Mokupuku, watching the locals unload samples from the vehicle and hose the shit out of it with pressurized seawater, were long ones for Kath, too, as she sensed other members of the 7 glancing back and forth between her and these, and wondering how long it would take Kath, too, to go that way, if she extended her stay. These people had created, and were self-aware and self-proud of having created, an original culture around the place where they lived, which for all practical purposes was synonymous with the ecosystem that they were installing in it. Not for them, scientific detachment. Was it really wise to station Moirans in a place where they could live as closely with epigenetic animal species as medieval Europeans had with their swine and their fowl? Were these animals scientific specimens, livestock, or pets to them? Kath, too, watched their uncomfortably familiar interactions with those animals, and they watched her watching them. They had woven into their dreadlocks the bright feathers of birds that on old Earth would have been called exotic, a word that was useless here, since humans had made them, patterning them after the parrots, toucans, and cockatoos of long-extinct jungles, on the theory that if colorful plumage had been useful to birds there, it would be useful to them here. Enotic? Anthrotic? Anyway, they were weird people, and they were lifers in the sense that no conceivable home could be found for them on the ring. Not unless they went back to sleep for a while and tried to roll back the changes that their environment had bent on them. But that was no easy thing. As long as a Moiran kept changing, she could keep changing. But if she stayed one way for too long, she would take a set, as the expression went, and find it hard to change back. These, Kath too suspected, had definitely taken a set. They were obviously interbreeding with the Kamite staff, who, in racially characteristic fashion, had adapted to the place where they had found themselves and were looking for ways to make it work for the people surrounding them. There was nothing wrong with that. So people on the ring kept saying, because it was the polite thing to say. Nothing wrong with breeds. But the truth of it was that breeds, like weeds, tended to be found in disturbed areas. A sprinkling was nice, especially in sophisticated places like Chain Hatton, but seeing a lot of them in one community was a sign that everyone on the ring knew how to read, even if they knew it was impolite to say what they were thinking. The behaviors that these Moirans had invented around everyday things, like the sunrise, mealtime, and the interpretation of dreams, had a ritualistic quality that to Ariane was obviously fascinating, and to Kath, too, was a little mortifying. For the first time in her life, she was feeling the stirrings of what was called old racism, the survival into modern times of racial attitudes or reenactments thereof that had existed on old Earth, had been altogether snuffed out, and were known only because documentation thereof had survived. On a certain kind of diseased mind, they exerted the same magnetic pull as they had pre-Zero, and so among a population of millions on the ring, you might find one person who'd spent too much time delving into a 5,000-year-old web archive and become infected with ideas about pre-Zero blacks that he fancied were applicable to Moirans, and so on. It was purely an intellectual curiosity, and not at all a factor in real people's lives, a thing Kath, too, had heard of, like rabies or Watergate, and she was fascinated to find it stirring in her own mind, here of all places. But that was only a passing notion. Presently, her survey mind kicked in and subsumed all under the scientific method. Here they were at a terraform outpost. Many thousands of these existed. Some were huddles of tents presaging more permanent works. Some, like this one, had been around for decades, others for centuries. Some were now abandoned, having served their purpose, and others had become nuclei of RISs, campuses for gimmicky schools, prison camps, or scientific foundations. A weird culture, utterly non-transferable to the ring, had formed at this one. If it happened here, something like it must have happened at others. How many? Was New Earth infested with bizarre cultural outliers centered on terraform installations?
Could you go to what used to be Uzbekistan and find a miniature colony of Ivan performance artists developing their own idiosyncratic, lichen-based cuisine on the rim of an impact crater the size of Ireland? To what was left of the Iberian Peninsula and visit a colony of Teclan juggernauts making babies with Julian mystics? How far could this go? Kath, too, felt some relief the next morning when, after a pleasant and uneventful camp out on the beach, they got back into Ark Mediba, now 90% empty, and took off north. The distance to the south coast of Blue Antimer was half what they had covered the day before. Around midday, when the sun was beating down on the deep eaves and shuttered windows of the military complex above, the Ark plowed up the harbor there and settled with a vast sigh into a fresh, sparkling azure chop. A smaller terraform post, annexed to the military base, sported a single pier long enough to accommodate an Ark. The pilots employed a variety of muttering and whining thrusters to get into its general vicinity. The rest was handled by robot tugs pulling on ropes wrapped around massive bits. The five humans who'd been sharing the cargo hold moved forward to get out of the way of the local terraform staff, who boarded the Ark, along with a couple of cargo-loading grabs, to take charge of what little cargo remained, racks of cages housing large carnivores. It was a mix of canids and felids, with a few big snakes. They'd been stashed in different parts of the hold so that they wouldn't wear themselves out menacing one another. Anyone who was connected with Survey, or, for that matter, who knew anything about the terraform at all, would understand what this meant. The ecosystem of Antimer was far more developed than that of Hawaii, and was now producing small fauna and herbivores at a pace that required the introduction of bigger predators to keep them in check. The harbor was an almost perfectly circular impact center, with only a small outlet to the sea. Most of its circumference was claimed by the military base. From somewhere in that zone, a launch cut across the disk of blue water and came up alongside the Ark's cockpit door. The seven descended to it by means of a folding stairway, and thus passed out of terraform jurisdiction without any formalities, or even contact with the local staff. Half an hour later, they were eating lunch in a private officer's dining room adjoined to a mess hall, and an hour after that, they were aboard an airplane, a conventional, powered military craft that took off from a runway, blasted into the stony shore of the island, a few miles away, and banked northward after it had gained enough altitude to clear the snow-capped peaks along Antimer's central ridge. From that height, the eye was no longer beguiled by the peaks and valleys that, at a smaller scale, made the place seem like an old earth mountain range. Here it was possible for those looking out the windows on the left side of the airplane to see 1,000 kilometers westward. The curvature of the archipelago's spine made it obvious that this was the rim of a huge impact crater, created by a big chunk of moon that had come in for a somewhat northward trajectory and pushed a high arc of seafloor and ejecta up above sea level. To the south, a smaller archipelago, curved the opposite way, hinted at the crater's lower rim. That, however, was not visible from the plane's windows. Instead, they all gazed west, tracing the arc of mountains as it grew higher and the land beneath it broadened. Somewhere along the way, it was sliced by the invisible line of 16630. Bard pressed his heavy brow against the window and looked long and thoughtfully at his homeland, seeming to identify hills and bays that he remembered, thinking of vineyards. Then Antimer fell away behind, and they flew for some hours over the featureless Pacific. The water was too deep in these parts for the hard rain to have visibly reshaped anything, barring another hyper-impact like the one that had created Antimer, and so the general shape of things was little changed until they verged on the continental shelf, just 100 kilometers or so south of what had once been Alaska's coastline. In the shallows between that and the foothills of the coastal range, a strip of sea and land between 1 and 200 kilometers wide, visible changes had been wrought. But the coastline was basically where it had always been. More effective than direct bolide strikes in the reshaping of the land had been the disappearance of the glaciers and the endless series of tsunamis that had been funneled into this broad bight over the millennia. The one hurled up by the Antimer impact had overtopped the mountains themselves,
cresting over what had formerly been glacier-bound peaks and slamming down far inland to boil dry on the hot rocks. Since the beginning of the cooling off, about 1,100 years ago, and particularly since humans had reconstituted the oceans by dropping comets on the surface, snow had begun falling on those peaks again. But it took a long time for glaciers to form, and it would be millennia more before cracked rivers of old blue ice oozed down the mountain valleys to touch the sea. When that day came, the settlement of Kayak would have to move out of the way. It was built on a heap of rubble on the western bank of a cold river that hurtled down out of the mountains, just at the place where it emptied into the Pacific. There was not enough space between sea and snow for an airfield of the size Kayak required, and so they had constructed one out of the mix of fiber and ice known as pycrete. This floated just offshore, a perfectly flat slab laced with tubes through which refrigerated coolant was circulated to keep it solid. Not a difficult task in a place where the temperature of sea and air alike was only a few degrees above freezing. Other than that, nothing was really here. Even the Terraform presence was minimal, it being easier for Terraform staff to operate from boats. The Kayak airfield had to exist because of the ash wall. West of here, all the way to 16630 and beyond, the chain of volcanoes formerly known as the Kenai and Alaska peninsulas and the Aleutian Chain were in a nearly continual state of eruption. Any pilot meaning to fly north or south across the 60th parallel, in the zone bracketed by 16630 on the west and the Rockies on the east, had to make allowances in the flight plan for the likelihood that their path would be abruptly barred by a plume of volcanic ash hurled into the stratosphere by any of 100 active volcanoes lying upwind. Airplanes were expensive, even more so than they had been on old Earth. They were too large to manufacture in the ring and transport down to the surface, and so they and other large productions such as arcs and ships had to be built in factories on the surface. Typically these lay on the outskirts of cradle sockets. In any case, planes had to be babied, given that high-capacity turbofan engines were extraordinarily difficult to make. Every flight plan had to include a possible emergency landing on the artificial flow of Kayak, which in turn had to be fully capable of hosting big airplanes. So what had been conceived as an emergency landing site had become something of a hub, where planes tended to land just because it was convenient and predictable. In any case, it happened to be the final destination of the military flight on which the Seven had hitched a ride, so they had to get off here anyway. It was about as warm and welcoming as you would expect of a forward airbase constructed on a slab of ice. A low cloud layer kept it in eternal twilight and converted all colors to shades of gray. Across a strip of water, the town sprawled on its rubble pile like a dead starfish. Beyond that was a black wall that they understood to be the lower slopes of the coastal range, carpeted now with young trees, but too obscured by mist and gloom to be identifiable as such. Higher up, just below the cloud ceiling, some of these were dusted with fresh snow, or perhaps just ice condensed directly from the fog. Had those clouds been absent, as they were for a few cumulative weeks out of each year, the Seven would have been able to look up above snow-capped peaks to a sky made black by the ash wall. One of the big volcanoes on Kenai had been erupting copiously for 2 weeks. The temptation to cocoon in a micro-hotel pod on the slab, to eat hot noodles from a cup and watch videos, was strong. Anything to escape the sense of being trapped between ice and sea below, fog and ash above, the Pacific to the south, and the mountain wall to the north. Instead of which, Tyuratom Lake announced that he was going into the city to sample its drinking establishments. He did so in a manner so bluff as to make everyone else feel faintly idiotic for even thinking of doing otherwise. Kath, too, Bellet, and Langobard said they were in. Doc demurred on grounds of wanting a nap, and Memmi, as always, stayed with Doc. Ariane seemed peeved and conflicted. The politics of race had been gradually coming into play during the journey from Cradle, and now Ty was pushing harder. According to a 5,000-year-old understanding shared by most who were not Aiedans and some who were, Ty was going to be the leader of the group.
This was partly because he was a native Beringian who knew his way around the place, but it was mostly just because he was the Dynan, and being the leader was a thing that Dynans did. Ariane had been organizing things. It was she who had somehow strung together the series of flights that had taken them from cradle to kayak, and in the early going she'd had Doc's ear. It had seemed impossible to talk to Doc without going through her. But since then, Doc had made a point of spending time privately with the others, and Ariane, after a day or so of confusion and irritation, had accepted this. The natural constraints of group travel had kept them all together. Now Ty was mounting an unauthorized expedition to the mainland, and Ariane was perhaps torn between the desire for that private cup of noodles and the fear that she would miss something. She ended up coming with them. They broke open one of the chests of gear that had been with them since Kayambe and found warm clothes. Then they hiked across the ice to some steps that led down to a little port for water taxis and made the trip, just a few hundred meters, to the shore of Beringia. A rambling stair, carved into the rock by mining robots, took them from the water's edge up to the place where the slope became gentle enough to walk on, and then they found themselves looking down a main street that ran inland for all of about 100 meters before dead-ending against a vertical wall of rock, a boulder that had been forcibly embedded in the flank of a larger mountain. Even from here they could tell that the boulder was a piece of the moon. Efforts had been made to pep the place up by making use of various light-emitting technologies, which now festooned the fronts of the establishments and bled lurid, saturated colors into the translucent air. It could be inferred from the nature of their advertising that the typical customer was military and lonely.
"I sometimes wonder," Bard said, grimacing at the taste of the local cider, "whether the Eves, being women, really got the connection between the male visual system and sex drive."
He was looking sidelong at a naked lady on the opposite end of the room. Kath, too, had little interest in the naked lady, but she had turned her back on the rest of the group a minute earlier to watch a disturbance. Now she turned to face Bard.
"Well, they were women. They had spent their whole lives under that gaze. Everything they'd ever been taught about how to dress, how to carry themselves."
"Yes," Ariane said.
"On, if memory serves, day 287 of the epic, we have the reality television conversation in which Ivy talks specifically about the importance of Dinah's persona and its treatment in social media."
"How can you remember shit like that?" Ty asked.
Kath, too, gave him a somewhat reproachful look.
"How can you not? That conversation took place only minutes before your Eve met the love of her life."
Ty thought about it.
"First Bolo?"
His eyes flicked away from the naked lady toward a screen above the bar, where a scene from the epic had been playing with the sound off. Dinah in a spacesuit, going out on the exterior of Endurance to figure out what was wrong with the misbehaving robot. No one was watching it.
"Yeah, First Bolo,"
Kath, too, said, slightly mollified. Bard, for his part, was focusing a little too hard on the tiny bubbles in his cider, the dents and scratches in the surface of the table, the electrical wiring bracketed to the ceiling. It was different for him. Ty and Bellad could look all they want. That was, after all, the whole point of the establishment. For a Neoander, however, to stare in that way at a woman, she looked like a Dynan or perhaps a Dynan Teclan breed, was a different matter. Not as far as the proprietors were concerned. The place was actually run and presumably owned by women. But there were other customers who had marked Bard when he had come in, and who were devoting almost as much attention to him as to the dancers. Had he not been in the company of a larger-than-normal Teclan and a middle-aged Dynan man with a certain hard-to-pin-down, don't-fuck-with-me vibe, there might have been trouble. A few of the other patrons might have joined forces to find out whether the stories about Neoanders were tall tales. As matters stood, the only thing Bard had to worry about was being glared at a lot, and possibly coming down with something because of whatever feral strain of yeast had infected the cider. The template and the general set of expectations for communities of this type
had been set beginning around 500 years after Zero, when Cradle had become sufficiently crowded that there had simply been no choice but to spread outward from it. The first outlying habitats had been only a few kilometers away on Cleft. In fact, nearly all settlement had been confined to Cleft until early in the second millennium, when the industrial base had developed to the point where other rocks could be colonized. Many more such communities had been depicted in fictional entertainments than had actually existed. This didn't matter, though, as the almost totally factitious and romanticized Old West had been to American culture of the 20th century, so those yarns were to the people of the Habitat Ring. So in the rare cases when actual settlements of that type were constructed de novo, as here, they tended to be built so as to meet the expectations of people who their whole lives had been watching fictional serials about their second millennium precursors. Even so, there were some surprises. Not so much the fact that it was female-owned. That wasn't uncommon in the adult entertainment industry, and anyway, some selection bias was at work. They had chosen to sit down in this place because it didn't feel as creepy to Cath 2 and Ariane as some of the others. More unexpected was the fact that as many as half of the people in there were indigens.